Hello, everybody, and welcome to Backstage Gaming, dramatic takes on your favorite games. I'm Chris.
I'm Dylan, just chilling.
Just chilling.
Chilling. Just chilling.
Because that's all we're allowed to do. So, Dylan, this week, as I told you before we started recording to part the window a little bit, we're going to talk about realism. Because, boy, howdy, that's a game descriptor buzzword.
Realism.
And the reason this is on my mind is kind of twofold. One, I've been spending a lot more time than I did in the before times, just kind of watching YouTube videos recently. And I've been seeing a lot of videos that kind of, I was trying to think of a folksy way of saying make me upset, and the things that came to mind were moisten my crumpets, and that's nothing.
That really grills my ham.
That really fries my grits.
Why do you fry your grits?
You don't, if you're a human. But there's a whole subset of videos that I personally find endlessly obnoxious, in which it's like, hey, we brought on a real-life historical swordmaster to critique movie fight scenes, or like, we brought on a real-world bank security designer to talk about famous heist scenes in movies. And it invariably turns into just like this person who knows a lot about shit in the real world bashing famous movie scenes.
Mm.
And it annoys the hell out of me because that's not how movies work. Like, this is my tiny soapbox, but like, what makes for a good fight in the real world probably isn't going to make for a good fight in film.
Right.
And similarly, a lot of really great fight scenes in movies make no sense if you examine like their realistic viability as a fight, because that's not what they're trying to do. A fight in real life is going to be cluttered and messy, and people are going to get hurt, and everything that a fight choreographer is doing is trying to, one, tell a clear story, and two, not let the actors get hurt. So
right.
It's one of those things that just annoyed me, and that got me thinking about similar things in games and takes about like certain game systems not being realistic, or certain games not, like games that are panned for elements of their design that do not track to the real world perfectly. And this was then compounded a couple days ago when Ubisoft released a cinematic trailer for the next Assassin's Creed game. I'm not super into Assassin's Creed at this juncture. I used to really like them, and then there have been too many and I've lost interest.
Yes, the before days.
Yep. Back before it was a fucking yearly series. But the new one is coming out, and it's called Assassin's Creed Valhalla. And the historical period that it's taking place in is the Dark Ages, at the height of like the Viking Age. And it looks cool. The cinematic trailer was very cool. It was a well-done trailer. Ubisoft has always been very good at trailers. And then the discourse started. Because
Oh, there's discourse?
Oh, of course there is. Because in this game, just like in the last Assassin's Creed game, and maybe the one before that, I don't know. I never played Origins, but in Assassin's Creed Odyssey, you could choose at the outset whether you wanted to play as a male avatar or a female avatar. And they're doing the same thing in Assassin's Creed Valhalla. And for some reason, that made the internet make angry gamer noises.
Of course.
Because why are there women on these Viking warships? Ignoring the fact that, like, that is based in historical fact. There is historical documentation of, like, Viking shield maidens and Viking, like, female Viking war chiefs. So, like, leaving that aside,
right,
that also kind of put this in my head of, like, how much are games required to be true to the real world? Because I would
also give those people, like, I was joking about this previously on another subject that won't be mentioned here, but give everyone complaining about that a swirly. They're the biggest fucking losers, and
right?
I hope they continue to get bullied.
You know what misinformed sexist pedants get? Swirlies. Incredible. But yeah, like that got me thinking about like game's relationship with reality, because I would argue that realism should not be the standard that we are holding games to. because reality is a lot of the time very boring, if I'm being frank. So I want to talk about some games that, like, very pointedly don't engage with realism, or very pointedly, like, put realism to the side, but also some games that do engage with a more realistic idea in a way that's interesting rather than tedious, if that makes sense. So I guess to kick it off, the first one I want to talk about is one of my favorite genres of games, as everyone who is out there listening to this should know by now, the stealth genre.
What?
I love stealth games. Stealth games are fucking cool. They are.
Did you know they didn't have water arrows in medieval times?
Yeah. Well, yes, obviously that's one thing. But that actually takes you to, like, one of the things that I kind of want to talk about is in Thief the Dark Project, which is, as I've mentioned before on the show, one of my favorite games ever made.
Also the game I was referencing people who don't know.
your main tool in that game as you sneak through the homes of the wealthy is your bow and an assortment of increasingly wild arrows. These arrows are things like, on the more mundane side, there's just arrows that you can use for fighting, or just, like, you can shoot at, like, you know, the big brass bell at the other end of the hall to distract the guards. Then you've got things like, you know, the rope arrow, which also makes sense. You've got an arrow with rope tied to it so you can climb. And then there's the water arrow, which is a very wet arrow that puts out torches. And then there's the moss arrow that makes moss grow on the ground so your footsteps are quieter. And they extrapolate out from there. But as much as stealth games work, stealth games only really work within an abstraction of reality. Like, in the real world, if I'm sneaking into a manor and there's a guard ahead of me and, like, a light goes out, they're gonna put the light back on, right?
Right.
Like, if they hear a gong noise at one end of the hallway, they're not gonna slowly mosey over to that end and then mosey back and start standing still again like nothing happened. Like, and this is something that's true of all game AI. Like, game AI is good when it is predictable. Mm-hmm. When it is maybe not overly predictable, but when you know what it's going to do based on what you do and you can plan around that, and you're only surprised sometimes. And that's not how people work. And if a stealth game was based completely in reality, it just wouldn't function. And this is a very simple and obvious version of the kind of thing I wanted to talk about that I'm using as a segue into...
Yeah, and I guess you were talking about stealth games in abstraction, and, you know, someone might say, oh, but Chris, Thief the Dark Project is... It's an abstraction. It's a fantasy game, not a real historical period piece like the Assassin's Creed series with their ancient aliens named after Roman gods.
Someone sounded like they're looking for a swirly today.
I mean, that's what... But, like, for real, you can't complain about fucking historical accuracy in Assassin's Creed, a game that is about the ongoing battle between the Templars and the Hashash. Keens? I don't know how
I think that's how
that
it would be pronounced. But also ancient alien gods and DNA time travel and, like...
Yeah, fuck off. Like, come on. The Apple of Eden was real, guys.
Like, you're gonna tell me I'm wrong?
Grow up, bro. Grow up. So why don't we look at, you know, a real, historically factual game that is completely grounded in realism. Let's look at Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater.
Yep. Totally. I mean, I don't want to be too real, but the final boss fight of Metal Gear Rising Revengeance proved to be a little prescient.
A little prescient. Yep.
But anyway, let's talk about Metal Gear Solid 3, because Metal Gear Solid 3 is a game that is full of abstractions but also has a couple of, like, really fun nods to hyper-realism.
Yeah. Metal Gear Solid 3 is, and it's weird that I'm bringing this up now, because I was thinking about this during work, because, oh my god, I was so bored at work today.
Oh my god.
But, like, you know, Metal Gear Solid 1 is a pretty, for the most part, 90% of the time grounded science fiction romp.
Yeah, and the other 10% of the time you're fighting a tattooed shaman with a minigun in a freezer.
Yeah, exactly. Schlocky action.
I love it.
Metal Gear Solid 2 is, yeah. Metal Gear Solid 2 is, like, a metatextual, like, I don't really know if I can call it cyberpunk, but, like, it has elements of cyberpunk. Look at itself and the series it belongs to. And then you have Metal Gear Solid 3, which is a science fantasy period piece that takes place in a jungle in Russia.
And that's a wild combination of genre descriptors, and I love it.
Right.
It's really accurate.
Let's talk about the Russian jungles for a second.
Yeah, hang on.
Yeah. Like, I'm not saying that there's a lot of overlap between Assassin's Creed fans and Metal Gear Solid fans. However, I will say that one of the alternate costumes Snake has in Metal Gear Solid 4 is an Altair costume.
It's not.
It is. Yeah, that's I can't remember if that was like a pre-order fucking, bonus or
I'm
DLC.
I'm trying to decide if that is more or less wild than the Prince of Persia outfit in For Honor.
I'm going to go ahead and say more.
Yeah. But not by as much as I wish it was.
I think he even, like, curls his left ring finger when he has that equipped.
Oh my god. Anyway, why are we talking about Metal Gear Solid 3?
No, I'm sorry, I gotta look this up. You can definitely edit this out. I'm sorry that this is gonna be messy, but... In Metal Gear Solid 3, it's... Like I said
earlier...
Set
in the dense subtropical rainforest jungles of Russia.
Yeah, no, I will not let that go. But... I think what it does is it and I guess someone could argue, yeah, but that's like James Bond. It's not going for realism, but it's also like, yeah, shocker. The fiction is honoring other fiction. Okay, anyway. So Metal Gear Solid 3 Snake Eater takes place in the 60s. It stars a spy who has to take down a giant nuclear battle tank that, instead of treads, has like drills. In this game, in this very realistic take on the James Bond, the James Bond genre of spy flick, he fights a man who controls bees, a former Soviet astronaut who's now, like, a fire demon, I think, a man who can shoot electricity from his hands, a ghost, just straight up a ghost. God, what else? I know there's like one... Oh, and a snake Spider-Man. I feel like if you can kind of accept that because it's awesome, don't complain about, oh, there's... What are gamers complaining about with the new Assassin's Creed? That, like,
there's
a woman who fights...
There's a lady with an axe in the Viking boat.
Who the fuck cares?
I'll tell you, I care positively. I think it's cool.
Yeah, like... I'm sorry that your weird fixation on, like, not even historical accuracy at this point. Just like,
it is historically accurate.
Yeah, and you would accept historically inaccurate shit from a bunch of other things, but when it comes to gender representation, you're going to draw your line in the sand?
Yeah, no, it's bullshit.
Yeah, come on now.
But Metal Gear Solid...
like a chump.
Metal Gear Solid 3 is wild because in the midst of all of this, like, completely bonkers... genre shit that's going on. Mm-hmm. Like, completely wild.
Yeah.
It also has these mechanics that, like, make you want to treat it like a very real world. Like...
Yeah, I would agree with that.
You have to eat. You have to, like, change your camouflage gear based on the terrain you're in. You have to, if you get wounded, you have to, like, tend to the wounds in a way that isn't just, like, click on the healing item. It's trying to draw you into this world that is completely wild with an emphasis on mechanics that are a little bit more grounded and a little bit more, like, still abstracted, but much more real and much more, like, asking you to view the world as a real place, which is kind of a fun tightrope act, leading all the way up to the fucking, what's the boss fight you can starve the dude?
The End. The boss fight's name is The End. Or is wait, the no, ghost? You're talking about the fear, aren't you?
The one where, oh no, you don't starve him, but...
There is one who you can, like, he'll get tired and he'll, like, eat some food, but you can throw tainted food out there and he'll go for that, and then when he eats it, like, he'll get sick.
And the way that you cause, the way that you taint your meat, if I can use the worst verbiage, is by just turning the game off and letting time pass. Which is, again, a weird nod to realism in this... otherwise really over-the-top world. And it's part of what makes Metal Gear Solid 3 so unique, is this weird balance between, like, I won't say very grounded mechanics, but more grounded than most mechanics.
It tries to create an illusion that, like, everything that's going on in the game is, like, its own real organic thing.
Yeah. It almost has the same vibe as something like No Man's Sky.
I was going to say Pokemon Gold.
Yeah. Where, or Majora's Mask, or all of those games that are built on systems that kind of, like, I think I've heard someone refer to them as, like, clockwork games before.
Yeah, yeah.
Where, like, the whole game is composed of all of these different systems that are kind of running on their own axes, and where they intersect is where, like, the AI takes over, and you kind of have to, like, figure out what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cool way of drawing the player into it, making those elements a little bit more realistic.
Yeah. I think something we talked about before we started recording that I don't know if you touched on was, in addition to the fear, there's also the end, where if you save the game while you're fighting him and turn the game off and wait a week, he will have died of old age.
Oh my god, I forgot about that.
Yeah, yeah, so Metal Gear Solid 3 does a lot to, like, make itself feel real, but it also doesn't limit itself to that. It's not going for Splinter Cell, it's going for Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah.
See also the weird, like, futuristic, we don't even have this technology that exists in 1985, circa Metal Gear Solid 5.
Yeah. See Metal Gear Rising Revengeance, the fucking jet propulsion rocket katana wielded by Jetstream Sam.
I said my sword was a tool of justice, not to be used on the weak.
I love it. But to wrap up, I want to talk, since I kicked us off with Assassin's Creed, I want to wrap us up with Assassin's Creed.
Oh, good.
And I want to talk about the first Assassin's Creed, because in a lot of ways, that was the most grounded of the games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the ancient alien tech only comes in at the very end.
And you don't even know it's ancient alien.
Yeah,
until...
it's just weird magic tech.
Yeah.
And it's the most, of all of them, it and Assassin's Creed 2 are probably the most, like, set in the actual historical period that they're about. And Assassin's Creed 1, and I think I've talked about this on this show before, but it remains my favorite design decision about that game. And it remains the reason that, like, even with all of the quality of life improvements that came with the later games in the series, Assassin's Creed 1 is still my favorite. The way that the missions are set up in Assassin's Creed 1 is you get to whatever city the mission is going to take place in, you go to the Assassin's Guild, and they tell you, all right, this is your target. Go gather information about them. And you gather that information by doing, like, one of, I think there's four or five different kinds of missions. You either tail a target to an alley and beat them up so they talk, you pick someone's pocket, you sit on a bench to eavesdrop on a conversation, you... Is that it? That might be it, honestly. It's been a while since I played Assassin's Creed 1.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's more than that, it's only like one or two other options. So they're very simplistic, and they on the negative side, they do get old. Like, you're doing the same thing before every mission. And then once you do those, you go back and they're like, okay, now you can go do the mission. And, like, usually there's a little bit of, like, an event happening that you are interrupting via assassination.
I can't believe the first Assassin's Creed is actually just Sly 2 and 3.
It's not that. But what I love is that if you want to, if you're just playing the game, you can go and do those missions and, like, you know, tick the boxes and then go and run right up and do the stab and run away.
Mm-hmm.
But what those missions give you beyond just being the boxes you have to check to go forward are they also give you, like, pieces of information. So, like, you might pick someone's pocket, and then if you look in your menu after doing that mission, you might have, like, a map of where on the rooftops all the archers are going to be positioned during the speech that you're going to be assassinating during. Or you might get the info out of beating someone up that, like, oh, there's this, like, this door on the second story that was supposed to be repaired, but my repairman couldn't do it. That might be a good place to sneak in. And so if you just, like, if you look at what the game is actually giving you, is it's giving you tips as to how to carry out these missions without actually placing those as, like, pips on your map that, like, go here, then go here.
You have to
actually do the homework of, like, looking at, like, oh, this is the gap in the archer's sight lines that I can exploit. or, oh, this is like the back route in that's going to give me less resistance and make it less likely that I get caught before I do the deed.
That's
really cool. And I fucking love that.
As someone who never went back to the first Assassin's Creed because it missed the quality of life features, don't hate me.
No, that's fair. Like,
that sounds really awesome. And like, whenever my friends were trying to talk to me about the first Assassin's Creed game, they never like were able to quite capture what made it so special. But like, now I kind of want to revisit it. I wonder if it has like a port on modern consoles or a Steam port or something.
I think it's available on Steam. Like I said, I haven't played it in a long time, so who's to say if I would pick it up now and be as forgiving of all of the quality of life things that are missing from it?
I mean, you're talking to someone who routinely plays N64 and PS1 games. I'm willing to put up with a little jank.
But like, that's the element of that game that I think is so unique and that I would love to see more games kind of do, is this like giving you diegetic clues. Diegetic here meaning like in-world rather than like HUD-based. Mm-hmm. Like making you take the moment. And in a similar way that like a bestiary in an RPG, like that kind of optional information that will tell you how to better fight the monsters, is another way of kind of adding. It's not making the game more realistic, but it's making the way that you have to engage with it feel more grounded, if that makes sense. And I think that's cool. I think that that's something that I would like to see more games do, is find ways of delivering information that are less gamey. That is what I have for this topic and for this Monday. I hope that you guys enjoyed it. I hope that you had fun, Dylan. This was kind of a weird one. I didn't really fully know where it was going to go when I started talking.
I mean, I was kind of dwelling on the controversy, so I'm sorry if that's
no,
if
you're
that,
okay.
Like,
it's been
shoehorned.
Huh? It's been fucking bothering me too. It's so dumb. I'm not gonna let myself go down this rabbit hole. It's just so dumb. Hey, everyone out there, if you're a sexist, don't listen to our show.
You're not welcome here.
I'm willing to draw that line in the sand.
Yeah, you know what? Fair.
But you know who else is welcome? You know who is welcome here? Everybody else. Well, good people. I got lost.
You had like a system reboot. I could hear it.
Yeah, because I realized what I was saying and it wasn't great.
All right, Chris, what you need to do is you need to insert like the Windows XP boot up noise. Really faintly.
Anyway, I hope you enjoyed listening to the show, everybody. I love you. And we will be back to talk to you again on Thursday. Until then, thank you for listening to Backstage Gaming. If you like our show, remember to leave a rating or review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We're also available on Spotify, on Stitcher, on the Google Play Store, on a whole bunch of podcatchers. Also, you can find us at our website if you want more info about us, if you want to reach out to us via our contact form, if you want to know more about me and Dylan, or if you want to know about some of the terms we use on this show. I hope you'll check it out. It's over there at bsgpod.com.
If you want to check us out on social media, you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter, where our handle is at @bsg_cast. Did that all without looking at the document, had to pull it up. Anyway, if you want to engage with us or talk about any of the things we discuss on the show, I recommend you use that hashtag BSGPod. Also, huge, huge thanks to our friend Brendan French for the key art he has provided our show. If you want to check him out, you can find him on his Instagram at instagram.com/BrendanFrenchArts. I realized I just plugged the wrong site first. It's fine. You can also find him on Brennan-French.squarespace.com. His name is spelled Brennen. And then for his Squarespace, it would be -French, but it's fine. You can also find his Twitter. His handle is @Brennen_French.
Thank you also to our friend BioQuery. He is the musician behind our theme song, Dot Sound Radio Volume 1 Instrumentality. If you like his music, you should check him out at his SoundCloud, which is soundcloud.com/BioQuery. That's BioQuery. Or you can search for BioQuery on Spotify. Thank you to the HP Video Game Podcast Network for having us on the network. They are a great network full of video game podcasts. And if you like our show, you'll probably like some of theirs. So go check them out on Twitter at @HPVGPodNetwork. And thank you, of course, to you, all of our lovely patrons, or people who will soon be our patrons. It's thanks to you guys that we are not losing money making this show, and that means the world to us, and we appreciate each and every one of you. And if you want to help support the show too, you can go check out patreon.com/bsgpod. That is all I've got for today. We will talk to you again on Thursday. And until then, don't be sexist.
Yeah, like really, it's not that hard.
It's not a good look, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.